Governor Pritzker says he wants to end the HIV epidemic in Illinois by 2030. Today, the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health joins us to talk about what needs to be done to achieve that goal. Plus, Thomas Mangelson has spent a lifetime in nature, taking millions of photos around the world. Now his favorites are part of a new exhibit at the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum in Chicago. And Camp Kesem is a sleepaway camp for kids whose parents have been affected by cancer. We'll talk to one Illinois mother and daughter about their experience.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, Thomas Mangelson has been photographing wild animals for nearly his entire life. And now his work is part of an exhibit at the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum in Chicago. That's coming up later. But first, nearly 40,000 Illinoisans are living with HIV. That's according to the latest numbers we have. The good news, though, is that the number of people getting HIV is decreasing. From 2006 to 2017, new HIV transmissions decreased by 35%. Now, state public health officials and organizations believe we could actually eliminate the HIV epidemic in Illinois altogether. Earlier this week, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced a plan called Getting to Zero Illinois, the goal to end this epidemic in our state by 2030. I'm joined now by some of the people behind this statewide effort. Dr. Ngozi Ezike is the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. John Peller is the president and CEO of the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. And Candy Krause is the director of teen and adult services at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you
for having us.
Dr. Ezike, I wonder if you can just start by laying out what the HIV epidemic in Illinois looks like right now in 2019.
Using 2017 data, we have approximately 40,000 people who are living with HIV in Illinois. The majority of those people are in the city of Chicago, about 24,000 of the 40,000. That's where the majority of people live. But Cook County is our hardest hit county in the state of Illinois.
And so the goal is to reduce HIV in Illinois to what's called functional zero, right? Which means no new HIV transmissions, no one with HIV who isn't getting treatment. This seems very ambitious, but I wonder why you think this is within reach, Dr. Ezike?
Well, just for a little bit of clarification, when we say getting to zero, the zero means functional zero. So it means that the number of new cases are so low, and for our purposes, the number is 100 cases per year, that number is so low that it would not be enough to sustain the epidemic. But again, functional zero, that's what we're trying to get to. With this amazing tool in our toolbox, PrEP, we think that's the extra tool in our toolbox that can really help us get there. With getting to zero, this plan was put together with years of planning, talking to community stakeholders, talking to people living with HIV, talking to providers. So in assembling all the data of what maybe are some of the barriers and why we were not there, I think all those things were put together in this plan, and now it looks like we can get there in the next 10 years.
And so when we think about those barriers, I wonder, John, if you could help us out by just explaining what PrEP is for people who aren't familiar.
PrEP is a HIV medication, and it's taken daily. When it's taken consistently and correctly, it's almost 100% effective at preventing HIV. What's really incredible is that we now have a pill that folks can take if they're vulnerable to HIV that's almost completely effective at preventing HIV, which is revolutionary. As Dr. Ezike said, that's really the game changer, or one of the game changers now. The challenge, of course, is making sure that individuals most vulnerable to HIV are taking PrEP and know about it. And those individuals who are most vulnerable are young, Black and Latinx, gay and bisexual men, transgender women of color, and African-American cisgender women.
Candy, when we're thinking about those barriers that Dr. Ezike was describing to us, what do you see as current barriers to access to PrEP?
I think the biggest barrier that we're seeing right now is that people don't have the information and aren't educated on the efficacy of PrEP. I mean, I think we're still talking to people in Champaign County who have never heard of it. Increasing people's understanding and getting information out in our community, this is a very effective tool. It's available, and it may be a tool that people in our community can use. And I think one of the things that we have benefit of is that insurance and Medicaid and drug prescription plans are very helpful in helping people pay for the medication. We're setting up networks all over the state to make sure that people can access the testing required and see the provider that they need to do and get the prescriptions paid for. So I think access-wise, we've done a good job. I think we need to do a better job of letting people know that it's available.
And when we think about that, Dr. Ezike, there's so many factors involved to accomplish this, right? And on the website with your plan, we noticed there the idea of training the public health workforce to adapt was right at the top. Why do you think that's such an important part of this equation?
Well, definitely we want people who are going to be interacting with the people who would benefit from this to have many different characteristics. We want them to be armed with the right information. We want them to be culturally competent, to be able to connect with the people that they're trying to reach. We want to make sure that they have access to the right resources that they need to be connected with. We want people to be sensitive to other things that might be also very critical, like, as John mentioned, some of the social determinants of health. There might be other issues that are creating a barrier, if there's housing issues, education issues. So we just want to make sure that everyone is outfitted with all the skills and tools that they need to be most effective in their roles.
That's Dr. Ngozi Ezike, who's the director of Illinois Department of Public Health. We've also been speaking to Candy Krause from Champaign-Urbana's Public Health District and John Peller, who's the president and CEO of the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. John, as we think about, there's the public health part of this, and then there's different roles that different community organizations, certainly nonprofits such as the AIDS Foundation of Chicago, will play in this. When you think about the community role of spreading the word about PrEP, where do you see your role?
I think the AIDS Foundation of Chicago's role is quite unique because we do a lot of advocacy work in Springfield. And so, for example, right now we're working on legislation that would allow minors who are 12 and over to access PrEP without parental consent. Sometimes youth, particularly if they're LGBT, often aren't comfortable talking to their parents about the fact that they're gay. And so talking to a trusted provider to get access to PrEP could really make the difference in the high HIV rates we're seeing among youth in particular. I think community-based organizations have a really critical role because we can engage foundations and corporations in providing additional financial resources to the fight against HIV. We can bring together sectors that are currently not at the table who should be and who really need to be providing additional culturally competent resources. And so, for example, we want to get the mental health and substance use treatment sectors to think about the role that they have in getting to zero by providing culturally competent services to people who are vulnerable to HIV or living with HIV.
Dr. Ezike, I wonder if we've talked about there's 40,000, about 40,000 Illinoisans who are living with HIV. That's according to 2017 data. What are we thinking about in terms of a population that may have HIV and not be aware of it?
Yeah, that's a very important point, and that is why testing is such an important part of this getting to zero plan. If people are not testing, if the availability of testing is not where it should be, you just have a growing number of people who may have been infected and don't even know and won't even be thinking about availing themselves of getting treatment. So again, the numbers of people who actually have HIV, of course, is a significant percentage higher than what we know. And so we really have to never take our foot off the gas in terms of talking about testing so that we can get real numbers and be closer to actually treating people and intervening in people who actually need our help.
If I can add to that, I think it's so important that healthcare providers routinely test people for HIV, which is not something that we see happening enough. An HIV test should really be like a test for diabetes or a test for really any kind of health condition. And part of the importance of that is that we see about a quarter of people who are newly diagnosed with HIV also being diagnosed with AIDS at the same time. And that shows that they've been living with HIV for a very long time, haven't had access to treatment because they haven't known that they're HIV positive, and they're pretty sick. And it's really evidence that the system is not working for many people with HIV. So routine testing.
Candy, can you just explain what living with HIV looks like today in 2019?
Well, I can give it a shot. I think that the environment has changed so dramatically over the last 30 years that a person living with HIV today is healthy and successful and has a great deal of ability to control their own health outcomes, and that we're treating HIV as a chronic illness now as opposed to something that's seen as fatal. And I think that the biggest factor in that is we have really good treatment. We have more providers that are versed in treating HIV disease. And so the days of, you know, traveling hours and hours to see a specialist are gone. And so and the medications are certainly more tolerable for most. And so I think the issues come in for people who don't have access to healthcare or have other life situations that are more pressing than their HIV disease, as John alluded to. So I think that those are the barriers that we face today in the fight against HIV.
Dr. Izike, I can't help but think about a conversation we had recently about the growth of syphilis in rural areas and how much that was because of a stigma of not going to doctors, not able to talk to people about this. And I wonder how you want the general public to be thinking about the stigma around HIV and AIDS, especially people who maybe think they're not personally affected by this or who aren't working in public health.
Well, I think John hit this very well. Like, when you see your doctor, nobody thinks twice about getting their blood pressure checked or having their weight checked. And we really need to be the same way when we're screening for sexually transmitted infections and HIV as well. So it should be, you know, for a primary care physician, if you're doing an annual, you know, those should be routine blood tests that go with your regular exam. So that takes some work on the part of the providers to make sure that they're doing this routinely. It also, you want to empower, you know, patients to let go of any stigma related to sexually transmitted infections and even be asking for it if the doctor doesn't mention it. If they say, oh, I'm getting my blood test, you know, if the patient could be empowered to say, and am I getting my HIV and syphilis test? Those would be appropriate conversations for a patient to have, you know, with their healthcare provider.
John, regardless of sexual orientation or life circumstance, what do you want? How do you want people to be thinking about this as we think about this goal of getting Illinois to zero by 2030?
So I think it's very important for folks to know that there's some really powerful science now that shows that HIV treatment is incredibly important for individuals who are living with HIV to maintain their health, and folks living with HIV who are treated early and continuously can essentially live a near normal lifespan, which is amazing news. There's also an incredible public health benefit to HIV treatment. And when folks are treated and the level of HIV in their body is not detectable, the science tells us that they cannot transmit HIV sexually. We call that undetectable equals untransmittable, or U equals U is the slogan we like to use. And it's, I think, really important for people living with HIV to know that they really can't transmit HIV to their partners if they're on treatment. And we've heard from people living with HIV that when they find out that news, they just feel so liberated. They feel like this incredibly stigmatizing fact that they've been living with, a fear of transmitting HIV to someone else, has been taken off their backs, and they can have a relationship. You know, not to say that they shouldn't use condoms and shouldn't take precautions, but this is an incredible news and really gives us a powerful tool to end the HIV epidemic.
Candy, is there anything else you wanted to add to this as well?
You know, in thinking about this, I'm just so excited that we're living in a time where we can actually talk about the end of HIV/AIDS in our state and in our communities, because, you know, it wasn't that long ago that it seemed insurmountable that we would ever, you know, our goals were just to slow the transmission rates down. And now we're in the last 6 years, we've seen reversals in transmission rates, and they're going down. And it's what I hope that people in the community hear from this is that there's hope. We actually have the science behind us, and to actually get to functional zero by 2030, and that we need to make sure that we're bringing all of our community along. But, you know, those are the challenges for us in public health and for our partners to address. But I believe we're going to get there.
Well, thanks all of you for sharing a little bit more about how we can get there. It is indeed really hopeful. I want to thank Candy Krause with Champaign-Urbana's Public Health District, John Peller, President and CEO of the AIDS Foundation of Chicago, and the Director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, Dr. Ngozi Ezike. All of you, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thomas Mangelson has been traveling around the world for more than four decades, making millions of pictures of animals and landscapes on all seven continents. His photos showcase anything and everything wild, from majestic landscapes to some of Earth's most powerful predators. His work has been featured in the Smithsonian, National Geographic, and Newsweek, among many other publications. Today, 40 of his photos are the subject of an exhibit at the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum in Chicago called A Life in the Wild. The exhibit will be at the museum until June 2nd. We had a chance to visit recently, but we were not the only ones. A group of elementary school kids were also touring the exhibit at the same time as us, and we were lucky enough to speak with them. Can you tell me your name?
Morgan. My favorite animal is tigers.
Oh, I think there are pictures of tigers here. Do you want to go see them?
That's a tiger! They're fast and they get stripes and dots on them. But you wouldn't want to touch them in real life.
I'm here with Deb Leahy, the President and CEO of the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum in Chicago, and we are at the new exhibit that just opened. It's called Life in the Wild, and it's a legacy, a retrospective of the photographer Thomas Mangelson. Deb, thanks for having us here.
Well, thank you very much for being here.
We are standing, the exhibit starts with a pretty iconic picture. I wonder if you can describe this for us.
Sure. It is the photo of a salmon going into the mouth of a bear, and it is really a spectacular image up in Denali, I believe. He just sat at the spot for a long, long time, taking images after images, and I believe this was the last image of that session that he was at. It really connects people to the world of nature and science, and that's what we do. If we can get that energy and that curiosity sparked, regardless of where it comes from, we feel like we are building the next generation of naturalists.
How much of this is about creating an awareness of conservation?
I think it's a lot of that, because you can't help but, like with the gorilla or even the wolves or some of the bison, you can't help but have a connection to that. And when you think about where they are, where they live, and I think if you can get the excitement over the existence of these creatures, that really starts the dialogue about where these creatures live, how we take care of them, and how the environment around them needs to be supported for them to exist, and the importance of all that diversity.
That was from our trip to the Life in the Wild exhibit at the Peggy Notarbart Nature Museum in Chicago. Thanks to both Morgan and Museum CEO and President Deb Leahy. And I'm joined now by Thomas Mickelson. He's on the line with us from Wyoming for more on his lifetime in the wild. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for asking me.
So, Tom, before we get into this exhibition, you're kind of in an interesting situation as we speak. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit of what you've been doing today.
Well, I've been out all morning looking for grizzly bears. I've spent 12 years now photographing one particular family. Did a book about her and her offspring and their offspring called Grizzlies of Pilgrim Creek. And all morning I was looking for 399. That's the matriarch and her cubs and one other set of cubs that just came out of the den. They're really tiny. And I went back home to call in. And as soon as I got home, I got a call that this bear named Felicia, that's her nickname, had just showed up right where I was 2 hours ago. So I raced back up here, and she's out in the snow right now digging ground squirrels, and the cubs are play fighting and rolling around, jumping on mom, and it's something I've been looking for a couple of years, actually. I haven't seen this small of cubs, I don't think, ever.
Wow. And so when you do that, as you said, this is a family you've been tracking for years, Tom. How far away are you from them?
I'm about 7,500 yards right now, probably 100 yards. And I'm just off the road, so I'm not in the middle of the forest or anything. I don't want to bother her cubs or anything, so I'm in a safe place for myself.
But what I mean when you're shooting pictures, when you're making the pictures, how far away are you from them?
Pretty much 100 yards. I've got a 600 millimeter lens with a 1.4 a 2X extender, so it's a fairly powerful telephoto lens.
As we were going through the exhibit, one of the things that struck me was just how expressive the faces are of the animals that you are taking pictures of. And one of our producers actually remarked it's almost like a portrait, except instead of a person, it's of an animal. I wonder is how much of that is also your intent when you're making these photos?
Well, I think I try to catch a bit of their personality, and it's always difficult, but if you get them looking just right, you can read a lot into looking into their eyes, like the gorilla picture, the bear picture, or whatever, especially with mammals, you know, who they are and what they're kind of thinking in a way. I mean, that's reading a lot into an image, but that's my challenge, is to catch something more than just a snapshot or a portrait of the bears.
And so by that challenge, I wonder when you are picking these images, when you're waiting for that perfect shot, how long does that take?
Well, I photographed a lot of things around the world. Tigers. I spent 6 weeks in India photographing two families of tigers for the most part, and was out every day from sunrise or before sunrise until dark. And then we went out in the dark a few times with lights to find them at a water hole and that kind of thing. Most I probably spent in a row, 42 days, photographing the cougar that's in the exhibit, and I photographed her and her three offspring during March and April of 1999. I was there every day from again daybreak to dark, so that was the longest at one sitting. But I spent 12 years photographing cranes and 15 years photographing polar bears 2 or 3 months a year. So one of the things I'm blessed with, I guess, as a photographer, I grew up hunting and fishing, and it's kind of an extension of that. My dad taught me patience to wait for, you know, the moment of maybe a flock of ducks or geese or something would come into our setup with our decoys and our blinds. And that was, it's made me learn a lot about, you know, waiting for the right moment. And so I just transferred that from shooting something to shooting it with a gun to shooting them with a camera. And I've been well served by that.
Mm. We're speaking with Tom Mangelson about his photos. And Tom, I imagine that a lot of people might be curious how you got into this line of work to begin with.
Part of how I got into it was growing up in Nebraska along the Platte River, where we had a hunting cabin on the Platte River, and I spent all of my falls out there with my dad hunting, and then in the summers we spent fishing. So I learned a lot about natural history and about behavior and how to build blinds and make decoys. And then when I got older, in my college years, I thought I was going to go into medicine, but I'd be indoors all the time, and I wanted to be outdoors, so I switched my major to zoology and wildlife biology, and had a pretty good basic training in natural history and then formal training in zoology and wildlife biology. And then my professor at the University of Nebraska in graduate school was an avid writer, artist, photographer, and he sort of took me under his wing, and I spent a lot of time traveling with him as his assistant, and I just got hooked on photography.
Mm. And so I think it's important to note that you've been doing this for more than 40 years. A lot of those images were made on film. None of your photos are digitally manipulated. Do you think that digital manipulation has changed what we expect out of photography?
What we used to always say was a photograph doesn't lie. Well, today it can, and I don't have any interest in making the image on a computer. I wouldn't even know how to be honest. It's not where my interest lies. But my interest lies in being out in nature, spending the time, being patient, and getting it right. And if I have to go back, like I said, I've been up here photographing these grizzly bears for 12 years and made a book out of it, and been also working on a film. So it's a lot more rewarding to me if you capture something, the moment, decisive moment, sense of the grizzly bear catching the salmon. But that's where my reward, my challenge, and my joy comes from, and not from digital manipulation.
Right. And that photo that you were just mentioned, that's probably one of the most iconic nature images that exists, and that's of a brown bear, and it's a salmon actually jumping straight into its mouth. I think probably most of our listeners have seen that photo at one point or another. I wonder if you can tell us about that day, how you ended up getting that photo, because in the moment, you didn't realize you had that, correct?
That's right. No, I read up a lot on bears. I also worked for a small film company in Boulder, Colorado, at the university as a cinematographer. And one of our subjects we were going to do, we're going to make a film about bears in Alaska. But I was up there actually working on a crane film, and realized if I took about a week off, I might go spend that week with brown bears at Brooks Falls in Katmai National Park, is where it was taken. And the bears gather in the summer to wait for the spawning salmon, and then there are a few big male bears. Their best spot to fish is at the top of the falls, and they just stand there like a pointing bird dog and wait for the salmon to leap the falls, and then every once in a while they're able to catch them in their mouth or in their paws. And I was there for a week. Again, I sort of pre-visualized. I had never seen a picture of a brown bear with just head and shoulders catching a salmon. I've seen many, many pictures of bears at the falls, full frame, a full landscape with maybe 10 bears, but never one. There was an immediate moment of salmon leaping into the mouth of a brown bear, and that's what I went after, and I didn't get it. But I didn't know I got it, actually, because it was on film. You can't look at the back of your camera.
It's kind of the final frame, right?
Yeah. So I didn't know about it. I actually got it until a month later when I got home.
Oh, wow. So it seems like you're especially drawn to powerful animals, whether they're bears or eagles. And your portraits of eagles are also something that are pretty well known. I wonder what you like about photographing those animals in particular.
Well, especially the mammals, tigers, leopards, bears are sort of the keystone or the major umbrella species in an ecosystem. And without them present, the ecosystem suffers, whether it be wolves or bears or, again, tigers or gorillas. And if you capture beautiful images or powerful images or images with behavior like the brown bear with the salmon, then you sort of capture the top. I also take a lot of pictures of eagles, like you said, and in many ways they're the top of the bird food chain in places like Alaska. I think they're just beautiful to begin with, the power and the grace and the gestures. I also try to include the landscape in many of my images. Maybe it's a small bear with a big mountain range, or a river, you know, a bear crossing the river. I like to get animals in their habitat, and I think that says a lot more, about tells more of a story than just a portrait, say.
Right. And when I'm thinking about the portraits, and the not just the portraits, but the pictures in this exhibit, you really catch some of not just the scale of that because of the shot of the picture, but then also the size of the picture and the photographs, because these are quite large pictures. I think maybe more people look at photography now than they used to, but they're looking on like Instagram on their phones.
Well, that's an easy way to look at a lot of pictures in a short period of time, but I think it's somewhat like going to a movie theater. If you want to see Gone with the Wind, big screen really works. If you see Gone with the Wind on your iPhone, it loses a lot of character and the sheer beauty of the landscape or whatever it might be. But I think it's nice to see them large, and just adds a lot more to the beauty of the place and the gesture of the animal or whatever it might be. It's hard to capture on an iPhone.
I wonder, to that point, how you think photography can be used as a tool for conservation. I'm thinking of 6-year-old Morgan, who I met there and talked to her about animals. I wonder how you want people to think about conservation and wildlife based on the images you're making.
Well, you know, little Morgan, I think she's going to be a great naturalist. She's got a good start already, obviously. But I think showing people, and especially children, teaching young people. Jane Goodall is a good friend of mine, and she's probably has the best handle on educating kids who then grow up to be conservationists or more aware of their surroundings. And, you know, we all can make a difference, as Jane says, and every day that we're out there. So I think when you see pictures, or whether they're drawings or paintings or photography or films, or you read books that people have written, there's many ways of educating people about what a special place we live in, and it's worth saving. And if we don't do something about it, especially with the biggest threat right now is global climate change, and we really need to pay attention, because this is a very fragile earth that we live on. And so the more people get turned on or get excited about the behavior of animals or the beautiful landscapes, and they think it's only going to be natural that they want to protect them, and they want to come to places like where I live, the Tetons or Yellowstone in Wyoming, and a lot of my pictures might draw them into traveling and seeing more of the world, hopefully.
Tom, I want to let you get back to the bears, but I wanted to just ask you, as you've been doing this for 4 decades, and I'm thinking in particular now of even just you're in Yellowstone and you're working, what makes you want to keep coming back?
I keep coming back because it's a challenge of getting something I haven't, maybe I've seen with my eyes, but I haven't been able to capture in an image. And so it's just sort of, in some sense, the challenge of spending the time, getting it right, and that means light, gesture, all the things that we consider art composition. And I love certain subjects more than others, maybe the obviously polar bears and brown bears and tigers, of course. Those species I could photograph all my life, but at 73 years old now, I've got to start emptying my bucket list here. That's one of the reasons we have this traveling exhibit. It's going to go to 15 other museums around the world. But I decided that it's important to show the collection of the retrospectives of my last 40, 45 years, actually, what I've been able to capture in the wild. And they're the best of what I have. So it's really great to have my work at museums like the Notabart. It's a wonderful place. What they're doing is great, especially for kids, and bringing them up to respect and cherish our earth and its wildlife.
I have to ask you before I let you go, what's left on your bucket list? What's the one picture you really want to make? And maybe it's about these bears, right?
Well, it could be. Maybe I haven't seen it yet, but bears today are actually, like I said, these are the tiniest cubs I've seen. They must have been born really late, and they came out of the den only last week. There's still snow on the ground here in Wyoming, so it's in that high elevation, I'm at 9,000 feet right now. So it might be a picture of a bear I've never gotten before, but there's things. I want to go back to India to photograph tigers. I certainly want to go back to Africa, probably for the rest of my life, to photograph all the elephants, which are highly endangered, and lions are endangered, even giraffes are endangered. Of course, gorillas, everything, so many animals are endangered. When I first started taking photographs, never would have imagined that a giraffe would be on the endangered species list, and that's pretty amazing. And most of these are human caused. I want to photograph more things that I can also put out there that will make people more aware of what we have to lose.
That's Thomas Mangelson. He's joining us, as we've said, from Yellowstone in Wyoming. Tom, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you. I really appreciate being on.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last year, more than 1.7 million people were diagnosed with cancer in the U.S. And a cancer diagnosis doesn't just impact the patient. Those 1.7 million people are also children, siblings, friends, and parents. Every summer, an organization called Camp CASM offers free sleepaway camps for kids who have been affected by a parent's cancer. They estimate that 5 million children nationwide have a parent who's undergoing cancer treatment or who is a cancer survivor. And today there are more than 100 chapters of Camp CASM nationally, including one at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Maggie Vecchiano is the co-director of the Illinois chapter of Camp CASM. Craig Passman is on the advisory board of the CU chapter, and both of them are with me in our Urbana studios. Hi, Maggie. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Thanks.
And on the line with us from Edwardsville, we have Amy Carpentier and her 10-year-old daughter, Murren. Murren will start her third summer at the Marquette chapter of Camp CASM this year. Amy, Murren, thank you for joining me as well. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Thanks for being with us, Murren. Amy, I wonder if I could start with you. I mean, I know from my cancer diagnosis that I had when I was diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years ago, that it's scary for you personally, but I imagine getting diagnosed as a parent when you have young children would be really difficult. And I wonder if you can share a little bit about what that part of your cancer journey has been like.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I'm sorry that we are part of the same club in that regard.
Right, it's a club no one really wants to be a part of.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. So I was diagnosed in 2010 and with stage 2 breast cancer, and I have an elder son, and he was 7, and my daughter Murren, who is on the line, was at the time 2. So they were very small when I was first diagnosed. And then 7 years after that, I was diagnosed with stage 4, which is when I found out about CASM. My first fears that went through my mind with my children, first of all, were, wow, you know, I have a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old. Where is this going to go? Are they going to be alone? I had had a good friend whose parent had passed from cancer growing up, and I knew from being a friend and a support what that could look like for them. When I went through my treatment and things looked like things were going pretty well after the first treatment for stage 2B, I kind of let a little bit of that rest, but cancer was always part of our lives. You know, there were times when I was in treatment that I just sometimes didn't feel like I could be the full parent, you know, that I wanted to be. And I worried about their feeling lonely and other things like that. And then when I got the stage 4 diagnosis 2 years ago, many of those same feelings came through again. And I felt that maybe it was time to really make sure that there was not just some counseling on staff, but also other kids around them that they could relate to and have that experience with. So we started looking at CASM when a student of mine who'd been a camper out in Stanford came forward and said something to me. So I think that the hardest part when you're a parent is that there's the parent you want to be and the parent you can be when you're in treatment, and negotiating those things sometimes are very hard for yourself, and then you have a lot of fears for your kids.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. And I wonder, as you're thinking about that, what did you hope that Murren would get out of attending Camp CASM?
You know, I'm an educator myself, and I feel that I've often seen environments where peer-to-peer and peer to slightly older, you know, mentor type age can really be beneficial for individuals going through tough times or through transitions. And I think what I really wanted for her was to have a group of people around her, other kids her, you know, age that she could talk to if she wanted, not feel like she had to, but that she could relate to other people because at school she doesn't have friends who've been through this. And so having other kids around that she could just talk to about it and who have some basis of relating to what it's like to have a mom who doesn't have hair or a mom who has scan anxiety, as well as just have some time when she's just having fun with other kids. You know, we would not have her be able necessarily to have her go to sleepaway camp without this opportunity because of, you know, the cost of cancer treatment. So those were some of my main things in deciding to send her to Kesem.
Marin, you're 10, right?
Yes.
What do you like about Camp Kesem?
Well, it's really fun. There's so many activities that you can do, and each day you get to, like, do something new, and every day there's a new theme, and they give you those themes, and you can, like, pack clothes for those themes, and it's just really fun. You get to do all this fun stuff, and you get to be with a ton of people that understand, like, what happens and stuff.
Do you feel like it's great to be around other kids that have gone through maybe something you're going through?
Well, yeah. It feels like kind of like a different than another stay away camp.
Do you go to camps in the summer, like day camps and stuff like that?
Yes.
And how is this different?
Well, like, I feel at Kesem you can actually talk about it and stuff, and it isn't as like weird or awkward. And then, but at Kesem you can like talk about it, and like just like other people will understand.
Yeah, they'll understand what you're going through, right? Which is a really big thing. So I've heard that at Camp Kesem, people have camp names. Can you share what your camp name is?
Yes, I am Bunny.
You're Bunny, so that's what everybody knows you as at Camp Kesem,
yes.
Right? And this is,
yeah.
Is this summer going to be your third year that you're going?
Yeah, I think.
So that's Marin Carpentier. We've been talking to her and her mom, Amy, and I mentioned Maggie Vacchiano is in studio with me here in Urbana. Maggie, I mentioned that you're co-director of the Illinois chapter of Camp Kesem. I wonder what it means to you to hear from Marin about how much this experience means to her.
Yeah, well, it's great to hear from campers from other chapters how Kesem has impacted their lives. I know that a lot of campers, they come back and they say how awesome camp is and they want to come back year after year. We get a lot of emails and cards that say thank you. We are so happy to have Kesem in our life. It's kind of something that campers, once before they go, they're a little hesitant, right? They don't really know what to expect. But once they are there and they have the full week to have fun and experience this camp, like, that's so different from other camps with people that actually understand what they're going through. They always want to come back year after year, and they always, you know, you see a new camper and by the time they're gonna leave, they tell their parents, no, don't come to pick me up, I want to stay here for another week or another 2 weeks. So it's just awesome to hear from other campers and to connect and just see how big the Kesem network truly is.
And how does this work? So kids go for a sleepaway for a week?
Yeah, they go for a week, and different chapters, there's chapters for multiple universities throughout the country, they go for a week and each year, so they can apply every year, but they can only go for 1 week in the summer just because, like you said, there's so many kids who have been affected by their parents' cancer.
Craig, how did you get involved with this?
Well, I'm a photographer here in Champaign, and one of our student athletes that was involved with camp and on camp staff asked me if I'd be interested in coming up to photograph the camp activities for a couple of days. And little did she know that that happened to be the same summer that both my mother and my sister were diagnosed with breast cancer within about 4 weeks of each other. And I also had experience working with camps, so I kind of felt like it was the right place at the right time with the right people and got involved quickly and saw what special things were going on there at camp.
I wonder what it was like for you as a family member going what you were going through with your family life to be a part of Camp Kesem.
Well, I heard some of the same things from my sister. She has two young boys. They're actually through high school now, but you know, they weren't as young as some of our campers, but it was the same type of feelings of, am I going to be there for them? Can I support them? And that type of thing. So I had some understanding of what it was like to need a place to be that you were understanding. And many of the staff, we've had similar experiences and people involved in donors and others that support the camp have had similar experience. So they understand the value of what we're doing there and how we're helping the kids have a good time and being with people that understand them.
What's your camp nickname?
My camp nickname is Nikon, after the camera equipment that I use. And so when I'm here on campus and I'm walking across campus and I hear somebody yell Nikon, I know that it's somebody from Camp Kesem.
And Maggie, I wonder what kind of training counselors you and the counselors go through before the camp starts, because obviously this is a little bit different environment than your typical sleepaway summer camp.
Yeah, definitely. So throughout the year, actually, during the school year, we have a lot of meetings, and every meeting we have a training. And so we go through an extensive process to pick the counselors. And then after they're picked, we have multiple trainings. Then we also have videos that we have to do online, you know, just to make sure everything's up to standard. We know what to do in different situations. It's pretty intensive. And a few days before camp, we all come to Champaign and we have a few days of full day long trainings just to make sure we're all on the same page and stuff. And then we head up to the camp. And
What kind of things are involved with the training?
So we have to make sure, you know, safety, making sure that all of the counselors are equipped with first aid and knowing what to do in different high-stress situations. You know, just your typical camp training that you would have to do if you are going to be a counselor at any camp.
And is there additional trainings that you also have, too, just because of the circumstances involving Camp Kesem?
Yeah, we definitely have trainings talking about, you know, what different types of cancers mean and how to go about if a camper comes up to you and seems distressed and wants to talk about their parents' cancer. And I think one of the special things about Kesem is that the whole week is supposed to be fun for the kids. We don't want to really focus on the parents' cancer because they're a kid and they want to, you know, experience what a kid has to experience and have fun and enjoy their lives like we all have when we were a kid. And so we only have one day where we really talk about cancer, and we call it the C word, where we really talk about cancer. And then every other day we try to just have fun, normal camp. We have tons of activities. We go to the pool. We have hiking, different kayaking, fun things that the campers can do.
Marin, what's your favorite thing to do at camp? Is it kayaking? Is it, you mentioned you have different costumes. Is there a particular costume you're excited about bringing this summer?
Well, last year there was a sea day, so we brought like sea-themed outfits and stuff for that day. And the thing that I really like about the activity that I really like about Kesem is they have a lake, and on the lake they have this like blow up trampoline type thing with like a blown up course over the lake, and that's really fun to do.
Amy, for you, I wonder what the week means for you as a parent.
Sure. This is one of the things. It was so funny. The first year that we were involved in Kesem, we got my diagnosis, and my student stepped forward and said, you know, you should really check out Kesem, Camp Kesem for the kids. And then we went pretty quick, so we really didn't realize this. But it's an amazing gift that these campers and these camp counselors give to the parents. My husband, Michael, and I get a good solid 5 days together just to reflect and to have some time to ourselves as well. You know, and of course we miss our children, but it gives us as parents a little bit of time together as well to think about what's coming in the future, you know, what are some of the challenges that may happen, and to kind of have just time for ourselves too, which is a huge blessing.
Maggie, for people who want to get involved, how can people get involved with Camp Kesem?
Yeah, so we have a website. It's campkesem.org. That's probably your best bet. We also, the Illinois chapter has illinois@campkesem.org. You know, right now we're looking for volunteer mental health professionals, nurses, and videographer for our camp, just ours. But I know a lot of, just because you're not a camper or a young child doesn't mean that you can't help. Just like Nikon comes and does our videography, there's different ways that adults can also get involved and give back.
I forgot to ask you what your camp nickname was.
My camp nickname's Ladybug.
Can you tell us why?
Yeah. So a few years before I was born, my grandma passed away from breast cancer, and my mom would always tell me if I saw a ladybug, then that was my grandma coming and being a part of my life. So when I joined Kesem, I thought it was only fitting to be called Ladybug.
Well, thanks to all of you for being with me. And we will have more information about this up at our website at 21stshow.org. But I want to thank Maggie Maggie Vacchiano for being with us, co-director of the Illinois chapter of Camp Kesem, Craig Pessman, who's on the advisory board for the CU chapter, and Amy Carpentier and her daughter, Murren. Amy, we wish you guys the best as well. Thanks for taking the time to be with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
That's all the time we have for today and for this week. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis, background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. All the links, every other way to contact us. If you want to find our other social channels, leave us a voicemail, send us an email. Just remember our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past shows there, and you can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify as well as iTunes and NPR One. Search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.